Oh, it's plenty of advice I can give the young artist. But I think that one of the main, for me, question is if somebody's an artist at all. Because, you know, it's just, you can't proclaim yourself a young artist. Maybe you're not artist, or you can be, you know, better off doing something else. So when I was teaching, this was one of the tests I will ask, you know, how you know you're an artist? That's the main question. And, you know, to know if an artist or not is like a breathing. You don't question breathing. You have to breathe, otherwise you just die, so you breathe. So if you wake up in the morning and you have some ideas and you have to make them, and this become like a kind of almost obsession, and you have to create, and you have this urge to create, you're definitely an artist. But you're not a great artist, you're just an artist. To be a great artist, that's all different types of rules. And you really have to, you're obsessed. It's like there's nothing else in your mind till you realize the work, and this complexity of the intensity of the that you put into work. And also, I think the great artists have to be ready to fail, which is not too many people do. Because when you have success in a certain way, then and the public accept you in a certain way, you start somehow involuntarily reproducing the same images, the same type of work, and you're not risking. And the real artists, you know, always change their territories, and they go to the land they've never been. And there is unknown territory, and then you can fail, and you can risk. And that failure actually is what makes this extra. You know, ready to fail. That makes great artists. And, you know, again, you know, if you wanted to, as young, you wanted to be famous and rich, then you just can forget even the idea of being an artist. Because the, you know, the money and the success is, it's not aim, it's just a side effect. And sometimes happen in your lifetime, sometimes not. But doesn't, you know, keep you away from working. It's really interesting to me. I have this great example. For me, it was the really courage, that you need the courage. I think the most courageous act ever in the history of humankind, you know, to me was definitely Columbus, you know, going to discover America. Actually, he was going to India. And then, by mistake, he discovered America. But there was this, you know, he went there with his crew, to little island called El Hierro. This is the last island in the archipelago, the Canarian archipelago. And there was this night that these sailors had, the last night before going to this expedition. But in those days, the idea of the planet, our Earth, that was a plate that you can fall off into unknown. So they took this risk to fail from the plate of unknown, and they discovered America. That's a good example for everything. I had a very old professor, really, which I love very much, and he gave me two advices. He said to me, if you are drawing with your right hand and you're getting better and better and become virtuose, so that with your close eyes you can draw anything you want, immediately change to the left hand. And that was very important advice, because when you become routine, that is end of everything. And the second great advice he said to me, you know, in your lifetime, you probably will have one good idea if you're a really good artist. And if you're genius, two good ideas. And that's it. But be careful with them. When I was young, I would have different ideas to do work. It was never linear. So I never wanted to develop kind of certain style that I would be recognized. So I would have this obsession about one thing, and then I had to do it. And mostly I would do the work that I'm afraid of. If I'm really afraid of idea, this is exactly the point I have to go. Because if you do things you like, you never change. There is nowhere to go. You're always doing the same shit again and again. But if you do things that you don't know, the things you're afraid of, something really different, then it's really important to go to this different pattern and something different happen. So I will get into these ideas that I don't know. But the other things, you know, just to give example of one of my exercises for my students when I was teaching, I would tell them that they will, 3 months, they will buy 100 just sheets of paper and one rubbish can, and they will put on the table. And every day in the same time, they would sit on that on the chair and write the good ideas. And the one that they like, they put on the left side of the table, and one they don't like, they put in the rubbish. And for 3 months like this. And after 3 months, they want to present me good ideas. I'm totally not interested in good ideas. I just took rubbish can, and we look into rubbish can. And every single idea was incredible. So we realized that was the ones you reject them, once you don't want to deal with them. But this interesting thing also, how you know when somebody, which media you should use. Because, you know, you may be born painter, and if you want to do performance, it doesn't work. Or you a sculptor. So you have to know what media actually, what tool is best for your expression. So for me, to recognize a good performance artist is really simple. You can perform, my idea can be totally shit, the execution can be wrong. But it's just the way how he stand. And that's it, you know, in the space, how he occupied physically the space and what that standing does to everybody else looking at person. That kind of charisma, it really makes the difference. It's a certain energy you can recognize right away. And you can learn later on, you know, how to execute things, the ideas, you know, and all the rest. But it's about energy that you cannot learn, that you have to have it. It's something that is just there with, when you're born. But it's really interesting, one of the lecture of the Bob Wilson, when I was doing the theater piece with him, he was saying to the actors and to me, he said, when you're standing in one place, and you're thinking to the next movement, you're already not present. So this incredibly important lesson, that when you're standing in one place, you can't think of the next thing, step. The next step have to come with your body and mind together. Otherwise, you're actually missing that moment of presence. So it's hard thing to do, but it's quite important. There are lots of exercises you can do to reach that presence. So, let me learn you how to drink the water. It's, you know, the water is something we drink every day, but not consciously. So it's very simple, it's like wine glass. It's not my choice, but that's where it is. And what you have to do is hold the glass in your hand and close your eyes and just feel it, the coldness and wetness of the glass itself. Breathe, think about nothing special except that moment of drinking. Put the glass next to your lips. Just kind of rest lips against the glass for a while. So the idea of this is to do everything one action at a time and nothing else. So the principle is, you can take a little zip of the water, feel the coldness, wetness, feel how the water goes into your mouth, goes into your body, nourishing cells, and drink this glass 30 minutes and nothing else. That's it.
Welcome to Art House Radio. This is episode number 40, the big 4-0. Oh, we've come a long way. And now we're getting old. That's where it is. Where this podcast is out of the tragedy zone. You know, if it's 39 or earlier, you know, it's a tragedy. But if as soon as you hit 40, it's still sad. It's sad. It's not as sad. So if this thing expires from this point on, it's just biology. This podcast is all biological. What can I tell you? You were listening to a clip of an interview with Marina Abramović. Now, who is she? She's an artist, and I have a hard time thinking of her as fantastically interesting or an egomaniac or both, and I'm not sure. I'm particularly not sure about the part where she paints Columbus in a positive light, which I don't know why you would do that, unless you don't know. I mean, it's possible you don't know. But then again, you know, you give them a holiday and you think, like, did they know? They must have known, right? Why are we continuing to honor this barbarian? But, you know, she's, no offense, European, and sometimes Europeans, it seems, think they're the first at everything for some reason, or that history-wise, historically, sorry, not history-wise, but historically speaking, that would tend to be the case by using the word discover. Can't really discover something that's already, it's already happening. I hate to tell you that. You, somebody in Spain is going to start a podcast called Art House Radio. I'm like, well, you can't do that because it's already happening. So, but hey, we Americans have our own problems too. One of those problems is The Path on Hulu. Great series. Love it. Almost through it. I've got about an episode and a half left. I would love to talk about it. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll do a solo episode talking about it. Very unnerving because you see these people behave in a way that keeps them in a cult. You know, I remember watching this great documentary on Jamestown once, and it just really rocked me to think that people could go that far, that they could be that deep into a cult. What happens to the human mind to allow a person to fall into that sort of thing? And it's also unnerving because you think about all the other things that exist around us, and they are cultish as well, but nobody considers that to be a cult, you know? I mean, you have, let's be honest, you have the Pope, who's dressed like Gandalf the Grey, and he is, you know, some sort of a grand wizard or something, you know? Like, come on, look at his outfit. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? Nobody should follow that. You know, we shouldn't be, all this stuff, like in The Path, they talk about the light, who speaks to the light or who communicates what the light is saying, or we're headed towards the light and you have to go through me. Like, that's bullshit. You're an asshole. How about that? You're a fuckface loser who thrives on people, you know, needing you. And it's more of a humanistic story is the irony. It's not at all about some sort of higher level. For some of the people who join it, maybe it is, but you know, it seems like those leaders just tend to be just like injured people mentally and physically from something earlier in their life. And I was listening to the Dollop podcast, which I love now, by the way, and they were talking about Tom Monahan, the guy who started Domino's Pizza. And you know, they went through the whole thing of where he, you know, his mom dropped him off at an orphanage and then she picked him up 6 years later, which is fucking crazy. And, you know, he goes through a series of, you know, terrible things throughout his teenage years and all that. And then he, you know, gets a pizza place. He works like 19 hours a day and then he turns it into a $1 billion franchise or whatever. I wondered if that's possible from someone who had a good childhood. You know, are those business people who start massive banks or organizations or pizza chains or burger chains or whatever it is, are those people who are trying to overcompensate for something that happened a long time ago that they can't get rid of it, like a mommy complex or some sort of issue? I mean, in the one sense, you'd think if you could bottle that emotion or state of mind and give it to somebody who had talent, think of all the things they could create. They just lack that sort of motivation. So if you grow up, you have a pretty good childhood, you know, maybe you aren't as driven to have something to prove because you're not sort of bouncing that all off of some traumatic incident that happened earlier in your life. And maybe that's why cults form. I have no idea. Maybe that's why we continue to do some of the things we do that are cultish and we don't question it just because we don't really want to face up to the truth whatever that might be. Anyway, on this episode, number 40, with Santos Ramos, we are talking about Marina Abramović, that clip, as we often do. We're in a car, we flip the old microphone on to go, and then we just start talking. And in this episode, we listen to the interview in the car, and then we talked about it. So here it is, my conversation with Santos Ramos. So we're talking about Shia LaBeouf.
Even Stevens.
Lewis Stevens.
By the way, I was recently in a motel all the way up in Empire, Michigan, which is like on the west coast of northern Michigan. And Even Stevens was playing on the Disney Channel in the hotel room.
Whoa.
It's a pretty big gem.
It's a big gem. Twiggy?
Twiggy. Is that his friend?
Oh yeah, it was his friend Tawny and
Beans,
right?
Ren. I always think Gordo is from that show, but Gordo is the cool guy from Lizzie McGuire.
Oh, Gordo, right? Yeah, forgot about that. Now, what was his friend Alan? Oh man, the people are gonna write in and tell us who Lewis Stevens' friends are, please. Tawny, it's like Twiggy, Tweety. Oh, God, I can't remember that.
Well, why were we talking about Even Stevens?
Oh, we were talking about Marina Abramović's The Artist is Present on Netflix, and she had this performance piece where she sat in one chair on one side of the table. It was a large space, and then people could come into the museum in New York at the Museum of Modern Art and sit across from her, presumably for as long as they wanted or up until a certain amount of time. And it was a big space, and it was like a performance piece. And so they just stared at each other. No speaking. You weren't allowed to like you know, show her anything or touch anything. And then you brought up Lewis Stevens as being Shia LaBeouf being somehow related to that.
Oh, he did a performance piece like that where he, I don't remember exactly, I don't know all the details, but he like stood in a room with a bag over his head and people knew it was him, but they could come in and say whatever they wanted to him. And that was like his, it was something like that. I don't know if I got all the details right, but it was similar in that way.
So I wonder if that was after he had been accused of plagiarism. Was that what he was accused? He got accused. Yeah, it was something big. Like he had written a script, or he had taken it from someone. It was either plagiarism or something big. And I wonder if that performance came after that accusation. That was a way for him to let people vent or cleanse himself of his wrongdoing, so to speak.
Yeah, to me, his, I'm not sure about his plagiarism, but I think his piece is kind of interesting because he's a celebrity. This other woman, how much money did she make? That's what I want to know.
I don't know, probably a lot. I mean,
interesting question.
Yeah, I think if you have an exhibition in New York and you're still alive, I would imagine you get a lot of money, especially if you're attracting people to come and interact. It's like an interactive piece, so I would imagine you get a big chunk of change.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure.
So we were listening to a short little 8-minute interview she did with Louisiana Arts Channel, and she said a couple of interesting things. We can get to the Columbus thing in a second. I don't know why anybody think... Why does anybody think Columbus wasn't a dickhead at this point? Like, how could you... The evidence is pretty clear. We'll come back to that. But she did say one interesting thing that I wanted to get to, and it was the idea about taking 100 pieces of paper, giving it to someone. She referred to them as her students. And for 3 months, they would write down the good ideas, and they'd put them on the table, and the bad ideas they'd throw in the can. And they would always bring her the good ideas, but she would always toss those aside and say, like, bring me the stuff in the trash can. And those were always the incredible ideas. It's a pretty interesting way to look at things. How many things have we dismissed because we think they're terrible, but those might have been actually the things we wanted to keep?
Yeah, probably most of my things. It'd be interesting to read the ones that... I don't know if she shares any of the things she threw away.
I don't think so.
It'd be interesting to see what those were, but yeah.
So when I was watching The Artist is Present, I did an episode on this last in season one where I was really moved by it. I thought it was interesting that there's no talking, you just look at each other, and for some reason I found it really moving. And the second time I watched it the other night, I started to think that it was slightly narcissistic, that it was more about her. Like, she was almost letting people sit down with her. Like, that, you could have taken two strangers and that might have been interesting. But because it was her, she was like the sun, and everybody else was like the thing, the people or the beings that revolve around her. Which, I don't know. I mean, I don't know her personally that well, but I just wonder. I don't know if you could say the same thing about lots of performance art, if it's kind of about them, but they're using themselves as a medium to convey some sort of message or statement about society. So I'm sort of going back and forth as to whether I find it incredibly interesting or interesting with a dash of narcissism in there.
Yeah, I mean, I never had heard of her before 5 minutes ago or 8 minutes ago when we listened to that clip, but I would kind of agree with that, just based on some of the things that she was saying, because she was sort of talking about, like, what is important to her about that has to do with art, or, like, what's important that drives art. And so she talked a lot about, like, courage and discovery as, like, the driving forces, which, you know, you could spin those words certain ways, and they'd be fine. After the Columbus comment, though, kind of tainted everything else.
Yeah, find a better example of courage and discovery than Columbus.
But, yeah, if you ever read some of the journals that were kept from like Columbus's journey.
Which still exist in Spain, I believe.
Right? I mean, I'm sure that they exist somewhere, but I mean, they're, you know, people have transcribed them and, you know, written them down. Horrific. Like, you think like Game of Thrones and shit is scary? Like, Columbus was literally psychotic. The shit that they would do to Indians when, or who they called Indians when they got here.
Little girls,
chopping off people's limbs and making them wear them. Like, seriously, Game of Thrones type shit.
That's crazy. I should correct myself and say that I'll give Columbus this. He had courage, I would guess. Like, you have to have courage to go across the sea when you think it's full of monsters and you're going to fall off the edge of the earth. It takes courage. It's sort of like the Bill Maher thing after 9/11 when he said he got fired for saying, I'm not saying I like what happened on 9/11, but you can't say they're not brave for hijacking planes and like, they're not cowards is what he said. Which you have to give them that. They're murderous, they're assholes, and they're terrible, but he's right in that they're, and I'm not a big Bill Maher fan, but he's right that they're not cowards.
I guess. I mean,
if you're
say lots of nice things about Hitler too. I mean, Hitler was pretty brave though.
You know, Hitler was a pretty good cook, his friends say. Like, he gets a lot
of, the guy could paint.
I thought you said the guy could bake. Like,
he could probably bake too.
Listen, we know Hitler is a bad guy, but he made some pretty good muffins, man. No, I don't want to accentuate that, but like, there's nothing courageous or uncowardly about, like, you know, raping 9-year-old girls. That stuff is, I'm not saying that stuff, there's an element of courageousness or courageosity, whatever the word is, but like sailing over the seas, I think that's, there is some courage involved in that. Like, there's courage involved in doing that now. If you were gonna sail across the Atlantic to Europe, even with like a decent sized yacht, I mean, fuck.
I guess, but like, don't you think that one thing that I always wonder is like, don't you think there's a reason why people weren't doing that in the other direction? I mean, is there something? Did they know something that Columbus didn't and all those people didn't? Like, it's not that they couldn't have, it's that the societies that were developing on this hemisphere were developing in a totally different way as opposed to Europe. Like, they were developing in terms of, like, you know, production and discovery in, like, terms of covering large masses of land. But I don't know, maybe there's a reason, maybe they knew something that, you know, those people didn't. So, like, we could call it courageous, but I mean, yeah, it just depends how you mean it.
I mean, only courageous in like the fear factor sense. Like, here, try to go over these waves in an ocean, and it'll take you 6 months to get over. Isn't it interesting that, okay, we don't really know, at least from my knowledge, we don't really know a lot of maybe what the people who were in America way before Europeans, what they were thinking. I don't know if they kept journals. Like, they didn't seem to leave, like, there are sculptures, like totems and things like that, but we don't, they're very different. Europeans are like keeping logs, and they put them in museums and in castles, but the natives weren't really doing things like that. The First Nations weren't really doing things like that. So you don't really think about the fact that they might have been aware that there were other nations or continents out there, but they very well could have.
Yeah. Well, some, there were many nations that did write. But also, yeah, like, it was like a lot of the indigenous societies were like oral based. But I think like part of the thing is that because we've sort of like are taught through a European lens of, like, not necessarily always about Europe when you're growing up, but like using those standards that derive from Europe, is like, if it's not written down, then it doesn't exist, kind of thing. There's lots of like oral histories that have been kept up, and so it's hard to, like, you know, they're invalidated because they're not written down or they're not in an encyclopedia necessarily. But I mean, I was just last week a mentor for like an indigenous summer camp, and it's all about teaching those kinds of things that have been passed down, and like a lot of them have been written down now, but you know, pieces of knowledge that have literally been passed down just orally throughout time. So like in different ways they survive. But I'm kind of interested in your perspective, like, because you lived in Europe for, I mean, you lived in England for what, 6 months? You spent time in Germany.
A year and a half in England.
You're there for a week, right? But like, what, like, do people ever, I'm interested how they view the whole colonization thing, or like, I don't know if you have a sense of like what they teach kids over there, or just how people talk about it, or like maybe they don't talk about it. I don't know.
I didn't get the sense that they ever thought about it.
It's like that didn't happen.
Like they colonized so many places, they just like probably didn't even, it's not even, it's just a blip on the radar. Like
to us, it's the biggest thing. It like defined everything. To them, it's just another, like, this is just like one place of many that they colonized. So
it's like one of the 100 altar boys that a priest raped, and the priest just doesn't think about him ever, but all of those 100 kids are like deeply affected by that in a negative way. So you've got all these different places that have been colonized, like Trinidad and Tobago, you know, Haiti, and all the France or England, they never think about them, but it's very much on the minds of the people who were sort of enslaved or oppressed or colonized.
Yeah. And so the ironic thing to me is, because I remember like around that time you would explain how Bush was president when you were over there, right? So you would explain how you were kind of, I don't know if you were embarrassed, but just like cautious, because Bush was like also terrorizing the world at that point. But like Europeans, and I think especially English people, have that air about them as though like America is not connected to them in any way, or like they have a totally clean history. I don't know how they throw Bush back at Americans. Like, they have no fucking recollection of everything that they've done. So, like, I don't know. So, like, what would you say about, like, that kind of perception of English people? Like, I don't know.
I think that's super interesting, because I actually think about this a lot. It does seem like Europe, especially for the last 40 years, has acted like it's the smartest and the cleanest group of people on the planet, forgetting like the 2,000 plus years of total bloodshed that they've had on their continent and off of it. And I think that a lot of that happens because, you know, they're socialist countries, so everybody has healthcare, they have a good rail system, public transportation is good. They're not involved in a lot of wars in terms of initiating, even though they participate behind closed doors with us, or they'll like lend like 100 troops to a cause. And so I think that they've used that as some sort of a get out of jail free card and we've sort of become, I mean, obviously the US government's done a ton of terrible things, but they've sort of, we've become the lightning rod for like all of the problems of the world, when Europe tends to forget about all the shit. I mean Nazism was like what, 70 years ago? Not that long ago. So I definitely think about that a lot, and George Bush was definitely embarrassing while I was over there. I mean, but I was more trying to get a sense of what, how they thought and the culture, and I was just trying to sort of blend in. I get the sense that the people in Britain were understood that there was this, there were a lot of, you could distinguish between the people and the government of a country, and because I think they've been through that sort of thing before. So I was sort of nervous that I was going to go up and buy like a shepherd's pie somewhere, and they're going to be like, yeah, here's your shepherd pie. You want some oil too, motherfucker? You know, like, but they didn't, they were just nice. They know everybody like doesn't have much to do with the government. And but I think the interesting thing about tying all of this into what we listened to with the Marina Abramović is that she mentioned Columbus as being like this sort of discoverer, and she made him sound like kind of an interesting guy, you know, like who was able to discover all these lands, and like, I can't remember the word she used. but she's European, so she's coming from that perspective. So a lot of times, like you said, even though it's not necessarily coming directly from Europe, it's those tactics that we embrace. Like, if you want to say this podcast should be about art, well, what about indigenous or native or First Nations art?
I mean, what is the purpose? Like, what's the value of, you know, that gets placed on, like, what's the purpose of art in, like, those contexts as opposed to what she's talking about?
Right, and if you, like, I'm not sure. We're on the road trying to figure out which way to go. Headed towards Marshall, Michigan. Historic Marshall. But, like, if you go to a museum, the Native American art is usually, has its own wing, usually. And it gets a lot of criticism because it's not like, this is just my perspective, but it tends to be looked at differently because it's not impressionism. It's not Van Gogh. It's not contemporary art in terms of Western European idea of what art should be. And New York and LA copy those Western European ideas, abstract art, non-representational art. You know, the Jackson Pollocks, the Bruce Naumanns, those kinds of artists. But in it's almost like indigenous art has to be, in order to get into those markets, has to sort of change the way that it is when that's more of that European influence, that sort of domineering force that's felt throughout the culture.
Yeah, so you kind of see all the issues that we just discussed with colonialism and whatever. Yeah, reflected in the value of the art, because, like, not that, like, all indigenous art is about the past, but, like, because of history and how, and the history of colonialism, like, a lot of indigenous art is about, like, trying to reclaim or continue certain traditional values, whereas a lot of European art, she's talking about discovery, she's talking about courageousness, she's talking about, oh, you never want to do the same thing twice kind of thing. I mean, that's the same sort of mentality. That's why they crossed the sea, you know, because of that kind of mentality. So it's interesting how those, you see just like the underlying mentalities, like reflecting the history.
It's interesting too that we say that's why they crossed the sea. I do the same thing, but there were probably a significant portion of Europeans who heard about Columbus sailing or colonization and were like, this is fucked up. Why would people do that? I just want to hang out at the pub and, like, drink. Like, it's not like all of Europe collectively thought, like, let's go! You know, like, same... But, like, no, I know what you're saying, but, like, that's the mentality, is we tend to think, like, in groups. So Europe, America, you know, and then you break America up into these indigenous tribes that existed a long time ago that are still trying to break away, probably, I would imagine, from that European... That voracious, like, exploration element that's sort of baked into their character, their genes, that's still being felt and is probably still happening, to be honest.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a good point. I mean, and really, like, the English practiced on the Scottish and the Irish for a long time before, you know, bringing it to this continent. That's where they got good at colonizing.
That was like their target practice.
Except actually, like, somehow, I mean, how could, that's amazing that, like, England, or that Scotland and Ireland even still exist is fucking insane to think about. Like, this country, England, that has colonized, like, so much of the entire world was unable to, like, fully colonize people who are on their same island.
Yeah.
That is, how incredible.
That's crazy. That's an incredible story, as told by William Wallace in Braveheart.
Mel Gibson.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. We're gonna take a break, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
So we're back again. We actually were just talking for 45 minutes, but I didn't press record, so that was part two. So we're back again. And you didn't hear any of that, unfortunately, and we were talking about Europeans invading North America, and then about how England couldn't sort of completely conquer Scotland and Wales, and how interesting that was. And the part that you didn't hear that we were talking about was about the cultural impact. How does a collision of culture, whether it's through conquerors or conquistadors or whatever you want to call it, how does that impact the art? And is there any art that hasn't been impacted? Is it possible for an art form to exist without having any sort of influence, whether it's against their will or they embrace it? And we were just sort of talking about Simon and Garfunkel and how they... Santos was saying that they went to Bolivia and some of the old Bolivian folk tunes from long ago sound strikingly similar to songs like, which one?
It was The Sound of Silence. And I was saying that the way I found out about it was interesting too, because I was visiting Mexico a few years ago and I was just kind of chilling out in the Zocalo, in the town square of, I can't remember which city. But there were musicians, just street musicians all around, and I was listening to this one indigenous band from Bolivia, and they were all playing flutes and I think some percussion, and they were playing this sound that was like weirdly familiar to me, which is like struck me as strange because I'm listening to, you know, these musicians who I'm sure I'd never heard before, so how did I know this tune? But then I realized that they were playing the melody of The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. And so then later, once I got back to the States, I looked into it and found out that they actually had taken or borrowed or used the melody from the traditional Andean flute music, pretty much note for note to my ear. And I don't know if they ever really acknowledged it, or I don't know if they were upfront about the fact that they used the melody, or if they used it, and I don't really know.
And so we were also talking about sometimes, because we both write music, so you have moments in your life where you write something and you're like, actually that's Nirvana. I shouldn't have written that. Or that's actually Beethoven. Like you have the, and I've heard comedians say the same thing, where they have materials and they think of a bit and they think, is this somebody's joke that I'm sort of, you know, reinventing? I'm not doing it on purpose, but it just sort of gets stuck, and you pull from your memory bank rather than wherever it is that ideas come from. I mean, that's probably a bigger question to ask. Where do ideas come from? And sometimes if you reach into yourself and you try to pull out an idea, you end up pulling into your memory sometimes, or is there a barrier there?
Yeah, so we weren't speaking of it in these terms, but like the idea of culture and ideas always being mixed, or always mixing, because I think that we tend to think that like when the two hemispheres met, like the Western and Eastern hemispheres, that the influence really went in one way, and that the impact of like the death and destruction and genocide was like the only sort of cultural shift that happened, without acknowledging or thinking about the ways that indigenous cultures of the Americas actually impacted the Europeans. And so, for example, like we've been talking about in terms of art, but also in terms of governmental structures and how the United States government structure is actually in many ways based on the Iroquois Confederacy structure. And I believe that like some people in the US government even acknowledged that back in the day, but like that's a fact that rarely gets mentioned when we're talking about the history of the US.
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea. We've talked about this before with technology, and you buy a device and you use it, and you think that you're using it, but it's actually taking something from you as well. So it was Revenge of the Dead Indians, I think, by John Cage, where the German guy said at the beginning that you think countries and cultures are about the vanquishers, but they're actually more about the vanquished. They have an ability to rise up into the culture like ghosts or skeletons from a closet. Like, you can try and hold it down as long as you can, but eventually it comes back in. So you can't just take over an entire continent and think that you can erase totally the tribes and the culture and the history that have been here. You're kidding yourself if you think you can get rid of that. You can maybe stamp it down for a while and think that you've got it, but really what happens is that it ends up being more of a mix than you ever could have imagined, I would think.
Yeah, and so, I mean, yeah, like, it's funny how often indigenous history gets looked over, considering the fact that there are still so many indigenous people, even here in Michigan, in the Midwest, all over the United States, and all over the continent, everywhere. But unless people see an Indian, like, riding around on a horse with a feather in their hair, or whatever stereotype they have, like, a lot of times they don't see them as Indian. You know, we don't hold people of European descent to that same sort of standard of, like, you know, nobody expects people of European descent to look like pilgrims from the 17th century, but for some reason native, like, people expect that of Native Americans, or, like, you're not actually native unless you fit whatever stereotype I have in my head from 300 years ago.
And we were talking about how we don't really learn that in history classes growing up in schools here too, and I wonder if part of the reason we don't hear about Native American culture or the different tribes, especially in your area, whatever, wherever you might be listening to this, if you're listening to this in the Americas, maybe it's because don't you tend to suppress things that are painful, whether they happen to you or you did them to other people? I mean, you generally don't want to talk about it. I mean, wouldn't that be one possible reason that at least subconsciously we don't want to talk about the actual history of this country because it's too painful? Nobody wants to face up to what their great-grandfathers or their great-grandfathers might have done.
Definitely. And I think that this is sort of an awkward point to make, but...
All right. I love awkward points. You're listening to Awkward Point Radio here on...
But, I mean, if you think about the difference between the way that the Holocaust gets talked about as a genocide in this country, the way that we talk about the Holocaust is compared to, like, the genocide of Native Americans, two very different things are happening there. And I think it's because of what you're talking about, because people don't want to face it, right? Like, and I say it's an awkward point because it's weird to talk about, like, genocides in a competitive sense, but, like, it's weird how quick everybody is to constantly cite the Holocaust, which didn't even happen here, number one. Yet people don't want to talk about the Native American genocide, in which way more people died. Way more people were killed. Like, I mean, I don't know, dozens more, I would guess. I mean, we're talking about dozens of millions of people.
Right. Oh, dozens of millions. Yeah, like,
to use the scientific term, dozens of millions.
I think a baker's dozens of millions more than the European Jewish population. I think that's right. I think people, we don't want to talk about it. I don't think that people are taught it, so they don't even think about it. I don't know that every teacher across America is consciously saying, like, oh, I've got to avoid that topic, keep them going. But it's just the way they were brought up, the way we're taught. We don't know about it.
Yeah, and it's uncomfortable too. So, like, again, like you're saying, it's not that people necessarily have, like, maliciously are, like, excluding it from conversation, but I think, and as a teacher, I feel like I can say this, that, like, I feel like teachers probably just avoid uncomfortable topics a lot of the time because they're difficult and can be extremely taxing.
Yeah, and it's if you go to any group of people in any state in the U.S., you probably get a very unsatisfactory percentage of people who know what you're talking about, at least in a vague sense. When you say the phrase "bury my heart at wounded knee" or "trail of tears" or anything like that, they might get a sense of what you're talking about, but they don't get a sense of piles of dead bodies, including children.
they don't even think about that as a part of the history. I mean, you even see the media. Again, this is another awkward point that, but like, what else do you do in this position? Because this is the position I'm in. But like, the media saying after the Orlando massacre that it was the biggest mass shooting in U.S. history. But like you mentioned, Wounded Knee, you know, 5 or 6 times the amount of people were shot and killed by the U.S. government.
That's a great point. I didn't even think about that. The Orlando shooting is the biggest U.S. Okay, I guess it depends technically what they're saying. The biggest shooting in U.S. history. But yeah, if you count Wounded Knee or you count...
How is that? Yeah, and how is that not U.S. history? It was done by the government.
Well, it's... Wow, that's, I didn't even think about that. That's a great point. Yeah, no, if the government does it, it's not a massacre or a shooting. It's policy.
Yeah, it's not terrorism.
Right. It's like that famous shirt of all the Indian leaders or Native American leaders with the shirt that said Homeland Security since like the 1800s or whatever it is.
Yeah, 1492 or whatever. Right.
To bring it back to that asshole. No, that's a great point. Like, there's definitely some suppression going on there, whether it's conscious or not. But the fact that nobody, it reeks of Donald Rumsfeld whenever I talk about this, because I remember hearing that guy saying, like, listen, you win wars, you lose wars, and nobody talks about the losers. And as much as I hate that guy, he's kind of right. I'm not saying he's right to think that or that that's the right way to go about it, but he's right that people don't talk about the losers. So I think, unless you're listening to this in the South, which apparently, you know, because the Confederacy is, they're pretty proud of being 0-for-1, you know, in the big one. They had one game, they got their ass kicked, and, you know, and you're on the wrong side of history. Sorry, I know that there's more. People will say, well, like Lincoln didn't like. I get it, but you weren't paying the help. But anyway, the point is that people generally don't talk about the side that gets shoved into the corner, under the bushes or out of the limelight, into the forest.
Yeah, so then it's like. And when we talk about not being taught in schools, I'm not necessarily even blaming the teachers because. I mean, I teach college, so I feel like I have a lot of freedom to teach different topics, and it's more about the concepts that they kind of guide me with. But, like, our sister teaches elementary school, and they are literally trying to script everything that she says. So they're not even just telling her what lessons to teach. They're, like, they're almost, like, scripting her mannerisms as well. So, you know, to what extent can you really blame teachers, like... Maybe a little bit of culpability there, but, you know, especially people who teach in secondary school, like, what can you really do? It's more about, like, changing the curriculum than anything else.
It's that we probably have an educational system that is based off of a textbook, which can be controlled by certain groups, rather than having an educational system where people are taught to thought or to think. Like, you just... I mean, like, take, for example, the Montessori school system where you have people who are teaching kids where they kind of have the freedom to move around and do what they think sounds good at the moment. And then you can maybe eventually come to those heightened intellectual points in your life through your own discovery rather than learning about what a fucking parallelogram is or who the 14th president of the United States was.
Yeah, I think I've been teaching college level classes for about 5 years now, and I would say that usually like lower level, like freshmen and sophomores most of the time. And I would say that one of my biggest obstacles in starting every semester is getting students to think outside of that mold, because they're used to teachers like trying to get them to conform to a very small box of thinking. And so for with good reason, they come into my classroom and like a very guarded and not wanting to experiment or try and challenge themselves to think in different ways because they've been punished for doing that for so long. So, like, actually the major work that I feel like I do as a teacher is to, like, at least in my classroom, like, first of all, convince them that in that space it's okay to do that, and that's actually how you do well in my class. So I don't know what that means, but...
Well, it's... The educational system is obviously so important, but I don't think what we're doing is probably working, and if it was, then we probably wouldn't have... I almost said so many dipshits out there, but the truth is that we wouldn't have so many people that lack the ability to know. It seems like lack the ability to form habits that might benefit them more, or to understand their environment more, or to be able to push for a better public transportation system, or to push for cultural elements in their city or their town that might create a better environment for their health, their mental health, their physical health, and all those things. And it all stems from what you learn in school. What you don't learn in school is philosophy and the real history.
Yeah. And I mean, but like you were talking about, like you were talking about it in terms of colonization and it actually being impossible to like totally stamp something out of existence. And so like if we think about that in the context of a school system, like kids still know what's going on. They might not be being taught everything that we should be teaching them or about the topics we should be teaching them about, but like I mentioned, I was a part of the indigenous camp last week and I was taking the kids to different classes. Like they were very aware of the fact that their schools are messed up and that they're disproportionately funded, and that certain schools, even in Lansing, get better funding than their schools, and they're not being taught the things that are relevant to them. So, I mean, they still realize that, even they realize that, and they're in that situation, you know?
I think that's in some weird way, that might be a learning experience that they're being gifted in some ways, because they're being presented a situation that has forced them to recognize that they're at a disadvantage, which is probably a sign of some sort of intellectualism. Like they have the ability to recognize that they are being, they don't have the same advantages that other schools have. Whereas if you go to a traditional high school in the U.S. or a traditional school, you kind of just go through the motions. You're not really challenged. You don't have to think about like, well, this. You might criticize the school or a teacher or whatever, but you're not criticizing the entire system. That's kind of a bigger concept.
Yeah, I just don't know that I was trying to think of what I thought at their age, like in early high school years. I mean, I don't think I was very aware of those things at all. It wasn't until after I, especially like going to a small Catholic school for my entire life from preschool through high school, like it wasn't until I escaped that context that I was able to start thinking about things in a different way.
It's interesting that whether it's escaping a context or overcoming disadvantages or overcoming your own lack of awareness, it's however you get there, it's so important, but there are so many ways to get there, and I think that the educational system thinks that there's really only one way, which is memorizing facts and taking a test, which is why they suck and why they produce people who watch shit TV shows and things like that. I mean, I don't think I was aware of very many things either. It took a while. Music and weed and whatever else it might have been.
But that was my path.
Yeah, weed, that was my major. But that's, those are the things that they do have an effect. And that's probably, this is a different discussion probably, but that's probably one reason why marijuana is illegal, because they don't want people making those connections. And they don't want people to be able to think for themselves and realize that they are getting screwed by not having better streets or better access to things like marijuana that are free, but they can drink a Bud Light all day long, or they have shitty schools, or the healthcare system is in shambles. things like that. Thanks for listening. Art House Radio is brought to you by people like you, beautiful people like you, who go to our website, arthouse43.com, click on donate, and then make a one-time or recurring donation. Creative projects are never free, and I say never free because I'm also including time. So if you create them, your time is valuable, right? Now, is it monetarily valuable? Yes. The answer is yes, artists. You have to start getting that through your head and our head. I'll include myself in that. We need to get paid, so they are never free. That's why any support you could give would be greatly appreciated. I want you to have a great week. Coming back next week, we've got a couple more episodes. I'm plowing through them. I'm trying to keep up here. I'm doing my best. I'm getting very little sleep. Well, actually, I sleep pretty good, but you know, it's stressful to do a job and keep up a podcast and do all my composerly and artist duties. But hey, you know what? So far right now I'm healthy, I'm happy, and you know, I don't want to look back at this time period and say I wish I had tried harder. So I'm just gonna keep going, man. Keep pushing myself and keep trying to scratch the surface on all these different endeavors and see what happens, see what sticks, see what floats. All right, you do the same. Let's hold hands through the iCloud and try shit and see what works, and maybe we'll get out of whatever rut we're in, or we'll continue going down a great path we're already on, all right? Until next time, friends.